In the first film, there's been a lot of discussion over the sick Triceratops scene. We have some of the earlier scripts, and due to accidental ingestion of berries and their antimicrobial properties, the Triceratops was said to actually be getting infections and tooth decay, causing its ailment. In the final script, what we know they filmed, it's explained that the Triceratops was swallowing gizzard stones. But we know that due to the heavily evolved teeth and lack of gizzard stones in any of the fossil finds, Triceratops didn't actually do that. Was that ever a discussion you recall being involved in or adding input towards?
No, my biggest complaint about the Triceratops was that there weren't any dinosaurs eating it. The dinosaurs were breaking into buildings and cars and everything else to eat a person, and nobody was out there eating that Triceratops.
That's funny. You're right, though, that the carnivores seemed a little bit more preoccupied with the people than a buffet that was in front of them. What's funny, though, is that ILM actually made a display of the Stan Winston Studio maquettes, and they actually put raptors on the sick Triceratops. Was that something you told them they should do?
Well, I kept telling somebody they needed to eat that Triceratops.
There's a lot of food there, I'm sure. That's funny. So with the films, you talked about how when you did consult, it was on set or when you visited Stan Winston's studio to see the animatronics that were being built. Can you think of any specifics about how your insight helped to direct some of the story or the design of the animals?
Well, anytime I'd go work with Stan and his crew, I mean, they were very good artists, and I would point out little details for them, but they were very good at it, as were the ILM. The ILM crew was really good as well, and I sat down with a few of them and would point out things like how they walk and so on. We did that on set as well when we had to make the big giant, puppet, the T-Rex puppet, look like it was walking. It needed to put its feet down properly. So, I helped them with that. And I don't know, always was working on the script. They always had some weird things in there.
Speaking of the scripts, though, one of the notes I had was a discussion from an earlier revision of the ending to The Lost World. You told a story of pelicans and coyotes as a possible analog to the velociraptors and pterosaurs in the workers' village.
I did a research project on the nesting ground of pelicans, and I was always curious about they nest on islands in these very shallow lakes, and I was always curious as to why it was that coyotes or some kind of predator didn't just walk out and eat the birds. And I thought, so I put on some wading boots and started wading out to the island where the pelicans were, and it was about halfway across before I discovered why the coyotes don't go there. Coyotes are a lot smarter than I am. I was being attacked by pelicans. I can tell you they're big, they've got sharp claws, and they've got really bad fish breath.
And you said apparently they didn't stop till you got to your car.
They were relentless.
Well, I'm sure a coyote learned that lesson at some point. We've seen some of the artwork from Stan Winston's studio about the Parasaurolophus and its representation in the film. Some of the original crash art showed it with a full crest, but there were revisions and notes where you mentioned that if it were female, the crest should be less pronounced. Even the mural art in the visitor center shows off a family unit with different crest sizes. Do you recall that conversation or what led them to simply using the full crest?
A lot of questions like that, but again, we don't really know. We just don't have enough parasaur, all of us, to get even a sense. We don't have any idea about dimorphism in dinosaurs. We have maybe three or four dinosaurs that are female based on medullary bone, which is the calcium buildup in the leg bone before they laid eggs. But other than that, or a specimen that had eggs in it, other than that, you know, we don't have any way of telling if we have a male or a female. I suspect they're more like birds than anything, and there was just coloration differences between the males and the females.
Like a peacock, where you got the bright colors versus something more muted. Yep. Exactly. Especially if the female is going to be the one lying on a nest, you want that more muted, hidden colors. That would make sense. Do you think that that factored into Spielberg's decision to make the dinosaurs a bit more muted in color?
No.
Okay.
No. They were muted in color because he wanted them scary looking.
Fair. Just end of sentence. Scary.
More teeth.
I said, you know, we really should have these things colorful. And he said, technicolor dinosaurs. He said, feathered technicolor dinosaurs are not scary enough.
I know in The Lost World, they try to show off a gender dimorphism with the dinosaurs, with crash art showing both male and female animals. The Rex is, of course, being a male and female pair. And some of the art for JP3 even had male and female pterosaurs. There had been some discussions about having the baby Rex with feathers, like in the book, but that it wasn't something they were able to accomplish practically.
A lot of this stuff was just technicality problem. We just didn't have the technology at the time.
Yeah, so they did what worked, what hit the audience in the best way, what was scariest, and what was most interesting. Awesome. Yeah. Speaking of The Lost World, during production, that script's ending changed several times. And there was a behind-the-scenes video of you speaking with Stan Winston, Steven Spielberg, and a few others about the design of the Pteranodon longiceps.
There are no pteranodons this big, but Quetzalcoatlus is that.
And there seemed to be some conflation in the production between that and Geosternbergia. You pointed out that the model was pretty much exactly that of Quetzalcoatlus, if they just simply changed the head out, though.
I don't remember that, but I mean, you know, we had a lot of conversations about all sorts of things. I remember little bits and pieces dealing with the pterosaur, but I mean, we just, you know, I tried to, you know, if there was anything that you know, seemed off, out of place, I tried to fix it. And, you know, there was just no way of knowing what would stick. Right. I mean, as a good example, you know, when we were out in the field in Jurassic Park and, you know, I brought a cast of a Deinonychus, you know, to put in the ground so that they would have, you know, a realistic skeleton to be excavating. And Steven, you know, looked at it and he says, "Okay, Jack, is this what you want?" And I said, "Yep." I said, "You know, this is great." He says, "All right, perfect." Well, he signed off on it. That's great. And then, you know, as soon as I was gone, he got rid of it and made it bigger. Made a styrofoam one bigger. So there's never, in that whole process, there was never really any way to know, you know, what you say is whether it was going to be, you know, it was going to carry through the movie.
In regards to dig sites, both Jurassic Park and Jurassic Park 3 show active digs in the films. How accurate would you say those representations were to an actual dig?
Well, first off, the site, the Jurassic, you know, the Jurassic Park first, the first one, Jurassic Park 1, the camp site was taken from our site, my very own, you know, I mean, it was taken, they tried to, you know, duplicate it.
Yeah, wow.
But what is funny is that they were in a preserve and they couldn't stick anything in the ground. And so they had teepees out there like we had in our camp, but when the helicopter landed, blew them away.
Very dramatic shots, I'm sure. I could see that being very dramatic.
So, you know, the trailer they were in, I mean, all of it was, you know, I mean, if you were to look at everything carefully, they had our kind of beer. They had, I mean, they had a lot of detail there.
Yeah.
And the same goes for, you know, the dig site in Jurassic Park 3. Mm. Joe Johnston actually came into the field with us. And in fact, he comes out almost every summer now.
Wow.
And so, you know, he did his best to get as much detail, accurate detail in on the dig site as well. So that was fun.
And the truck that Alan drives in Jurassic Park 3 has been rumored to be your truck?
It wasn't mine, but okay. It's a spitting image of mine.
Oh!
Same color, I mean, same year. I was impressed that he was able to find one.
Yeah. Wow, that's some attention to detail, which I suppose, though, makes sense. I mean, Joe Johnston is known for his artistic eye. His drawings and designs, he's worked on Star Wars, the original trilogy, Raiders of the Lost Ark, even the original Battlestar Galactica. I can imagine having him out there would be like an invaluable asset, though. He'd be able to sketch all the digs.
Well, he didn't come draw anything. He was dead set on finding a T-Rex.
I'm sure he'll find one. I know you've been able to find a few, so with your combined luck, I'm sure he will. I'm not sure if it's something a lot of people noticed in Jurassic Park, and I might ruin it for some people, but you can kind of tell when they cut from the first unit on location work to the second unit reshoots, because what they did on location was very delicate, but anything on the second unit, they're just going at it, digging it out.
Like I said, I signed off on one version, and
yeah.
Who knows what they used.
That's fair. Jurassic Park is, of course, about bringing dinosaurs back, finding amber with mosquitoes, and possibly preserving prehistoric blood. But we've since learned that the study Crichton references actually had its results contaminated, so no DNA was ever found in the amber. What do you think of our ability to bring animals back and the narrative stance on if we should?
Well, I'm fine with it. We still have the Dino Chicken Project. There are still researchers working on it, and we've made a lot of progress. I mean, but we've discovered that some of the characteristics that would be cool to bring back, like the long tail, are not atavistic genes. They're not ancestral genes. So they're not there to turn back on again. So I was hoping they would be, because I mean, they are in us. I mean, every once in a while, children are born with a few extra vertebrae. So that gene or that genetic pathway exists in humans. Before a month ago, I was very surprised that it wasn't in birds as well. But a month ago or so, we actually learned some very interesting things about that evolutionary sequence from dinosaurs to birds, and I can't tell you about it because we have a scientific paper that we're trying to get submitted to a fancy journal. So
awesome. Well, we will definitely keep an eye out for that. That sounds really exciting, because I've seen that with the bringing back the teeth, and like you said, attempting with the tail.
Yeah, there are a lot of atavistic genes. I mean, birds have a number of them, and a few laboratories around have actually, you know, figured out ways that they could be brought, you know, that we could get some of these back into a bird. And so, you know, that's interesting. And the coolest thing of all, though, is, you know, I mean, I'd like to love to have a baby, a pet dinosaur, right? Well, one that wasn't going to get too big. We don't want to pet Triceratops because it's bigger than my house. but the whole, you know, the whole research project in looking at these kinds of things is spinning off some really incredible science that a lot of it is applicable to, you know, modern medicine and a lot to just, you know, understanding the evolutionary sequence between dinosaurs and birds. So, you know, we're learning an awful lot of stuff, and it's stuff that we wouldn't have learned otherwise. I mean, you know, it takes a crazy idea first, right? You know, and the idea of trying to bring back a dinosaur is a crazy idea by anybody's, you know, evaluation of it. But like I say, the really cool thing about it is all of what we're learning, having to do with so many other branches of science.
In Jurassic World's ancillary materials, they actually discuss how they were reaching a 99% purity.
In dozens of species.
And how you could then see the lineage of all the dinosaurs. So by looking back, you can see how those steps diverge and where something starts or where another one continued. And with modern medicine, there are many genetic conditions where the gene either isn't activated or another one is, which causes changes in growth, lack of production of something needed for life. So by doing this, you could learn how to heal or to prevent certain genetic conditions. It's actually a very bold idea from what seems like a very simple concept.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, one day we will be able to make whatever we want to make. I mean, once we have a better understanding of the genes and the pathways that, you know, we will be able to do this stuff. I mean, we're already doing lots of genetic engineering. It's not like it's a brand new field or anything. I mean, you know, we've got all kinds of, virtually everything in our lives is some kind of GMO.
Right. Yeah, that is very true. It's in a lot of different things, between foods, between medications. Yeah, it's definitely everywhere.
All of our pets, right?
That's true as well. Yes, selective breeding, exactly. Or farm animals, exactly. So Crichton tends to be very cautionary with his science and morality tales, highlighting man's hubris, for example. But the truth of it is, of course, that there is an avenue to do this responsibly or safely. Do you feel that's where we're moving towards? Or is it more of, as they say in the films,
this is how you play God?
My response to the playing God thing is always the same. There is no God, you can't play God. If there is a God, he gave us all these tools, so why not use them?
Love it. I love it.
Mm-hmm. You know, don't want us making animals, don't give us the tools.
Right. No, that's very fair.
It just doesn't make any sense, you know, but you know, when it comes down to, you know, right and wrong, scientists don't have any business trying to figure that out anyway, really. I mean, scientists should, you know, as far as I'm concerned, we should figure out everything we can do, right? I don't mean we're going to do it, but you know, there's not very many instances you can think of where a person says, well, we know how to do that, but we shouldn't do it. Or we think we know how we might do it, but we shouldn't do it because of whatever. I mean, you know, the thing is, it's just like, you know, it's like an atom bomb, right? I mean, no, we shouldn't use them. But on the other hand, we should at least know how to make one in case somebody else decides to make one, right?
And by learning that, we've learned the concepts that lay the foundation for space travel or energy production or for further steps like fission or nuclear medicine.
Exactly. All sorts of things. But the point is that, you know, science, you know, we should at least push to understand as much as possible.
That's actually a really great segue, because I'd like to discuss your approach to paleontology. In the past, you have seemingly been a voice for a lot of questions that might be considered radical, or even simply radical for posing the question, or saying, what can we learn about this? A few notable conversations you've been a part of are the T-Rex and its predatory patterns, or even the TED Talk where you discuss the growth patterns in species like the Triceratops and Torosaurus, or Pachycephalosaurus and Dracorex and Stegomalac. Are there any particular theories that you feel passionate about, or do you feel that these are more questions that you're asking because a scientist should be asking these questions?
Well, you know, I mean, I science is supposed to be objective. So, you know, you're not supposed to have your pet, you know, scientists shouldn't have a, you know, their pet ideas of what how things are and then go out and look for evidence to support them. You know, science True. Is the opposite of that, right? We propose a hypothesis and then we try to falsify it. And so, you know, the idea of, you know, T-Rex and how it feeds, you know, I get hate mail for, you know, I mean, I get people who send nasty letters to me, you know, and some of them are little kids, just, you know, they're very passionate about their T-Rex being an apex predator. And I try to use it to teach people that, you know, that's not being objective. You can't just look for all the evidence to support your hypothesis. You need to try to actually falsify it. Try to. And so this, you know, I try to do this with kids, you know, so they understand how science works. But it's, you know, it's even hard to get a scientist, you know, that to do the same thing, because most, you know, most scientists don't like the idea of T-Rex, you know, being a scavenger either. And I say, you know, let's be objective and look at all the evidence and just see, you know, what are the opportunities for T-Rex? I mean, you know, you compare the skeleton of a T-Rex to a velociraptor and they look night and day different, right? I mean, so those animals are doing something that are night and day different. And to say they're doing exactly the same thing is just ludicrous. I mean, it's, you know, they're, so, you know, I try to use these kinds of arguments just to so people understand how we do the scientific method with the simplicity of science. But boy, I'll tell you, when people have, you know, have set their mind on what they want a particular animal to do for a living, they're not really, you know, ripe for objectivity.
Right. Well, even with the pelican story, you're drawing a direct analog between a pterosaur and a pelican and the raptor and the coyote. Do you find that helps drawing modern comparisons to look at the biomes and ecological niches and how the animals would act in them?
Yeah, no, it's like, so, you know, for years, I didn't really publish a paper about T-Rex. And finally, when we did our big Hell Creek project where we could, you know, where we were finding incredible amounts of stuff, you know, we just based on population, you know, quote, populations of things, what we were finding most of, suggested that T-Rex was probably an opportunist, right? And an opportunist is like a hyena, right? I mean, a hyena is an opportunist. It can, you know, it's not going to chase down gazelles like a cheetah. It's going to take whatever is easiest to get. And if it's dead, it's dead. It'll eat that too. So, I mean, that's basically what a T-Rex is a big hyena. And there's lots of them in the Serengeti, and there's lots of T-Rexes in its ecosystem. So, you know, that makes sense. So, but again, you know, you start talking about that to the general public or even to scientists, and they're like, well, there's the, you know, but think about this and but think about that, but think, you know, rather than trying to falsify that hypothesis, they're just looking for something to support their own. And again, that's not how we do science. You know, that's just not the right way to do it. So
you're right. I mean, science is intended to be impartial. Here's my hypothesis. What proves it? What disproves it? And what does the evidence tell me? How do I improve my hypothesis to better fit what we're seeing? And I think as people, that can be very hard because we all have a tendency to say, this is my hypothesis and here are the things that support it.
Exactly. That's right. Yep, that's unfortunate. But, and that's sort of the, you know, that's the Draco Rex problem. That's the, you know, the Triceratops problem. People, you know, they don't, you know, the idea that Torosaurus is a adult Triceratops is just mind-boggling to most people. And they keep saying, oh, it's got holes in its frill. It's got holes in its frill, you know? And, you know, quite frankly, that's the only difference between them, right? Except Torosaurus is a lot bigger than a Triceratops. And so, you know, a lot bigger just tells me that, you know, it kept growing.
And I know one of the issues you spoke to in your TED talk was that in order to approve a lot of these, you have to have access to the specimens to be able to do a core drill of the bone to see the growth pattern. And if you don't have the specimen or there's not that many, you'd have to get permission to, including from people who may not have a lot of buy-off on your hypothesis and may not wish to do that to the specimen.
Well, I didn't because, you know, I'd collect dinosaurs myself, so I didn't have to go ask about somebody else's. But yeah, I mean, that was how I tried to falsify the hypothesis, right? We propose the hypothesis, then we look at bone histology to attempt to disprove it, and it didn't disprove it. It supported it. So, you know, there again, that's that. You know, you start accumulating evidence like that, and if somebody's going to, you know, go in and falsify it, they need to accumulate their own information, not just argue with it.
Our three-part interview with Jack Horner continues next week, where we discuss behind-the-scenes stories from the films Paleontology and exciting updates on Jack's current work.